regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep their arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. I am glad you're with me on the program today. We're going to be talking with our friend Jim Wallace of the Gun Owners Action League once again. Now, I know we just had Jim on the show a couple of days ago, but there are strange doings afoot in Massachusetts here with the Lawful Citizens Imprisonment Act, the Devil's Snare, whatever you want to call it, H-4885, this sweeping gun control bill that was signed into law by Governor Maury Healey back in July. With an effective date, we thought that was going to be August 1st or 2nd. Then it turned out, now it's going to be October 23rd for a lot of these provisions. And now the legislature is walking back one of those deadlines yet again, suspending the new training requirements that were supposed to take effect a month from now. But they didn't do it publicly. They have not sent out any press releases alerting the public or licensing authorities of the suspension. Nope. Once again, doing a lot of things behind closed doors, and it's up to the eagle eyes at Goal and other groups to actually figure out what the heck is going on with the gun laws in the state of Massachusetts. So with that in mind, I thought it would be good to have Jim back on the show to talk about the latest machinations in the Massachusetts legislature, what it means for gun owners, and whether the fix that was announced – well, not announced. The fix that was put in place by lawmakers actually fixes all of the problems with the bill. Here's a hint. It does not. Take a look and a listen. Jim, thanks so much for coming back on the show. It's good to see you again.
Cam, welcome back to the Second Amendment battleground state, the insane asylum that is Massachusetts.
Yeah, honestly, I didn't think we'd be having you on quite as close, as your last appearance. But when I saw this email alert from the Gun Owners Action League yesterday, I thought, well, we got to talk with Jim about this. So you and I have been discussing the new training mandates that are supposed to go into effect October 23rd. Those mandates, the new training curriculum has not yet been developed by the Massachusetts State Police, which is a big problem. And despite the fact that Representative Michael Day, the architect of H-4885, the Devil's Snare, the Lawful Citizens Imprisonment Act, Chapter 35, whatever you want to call it, he has said that, groups like the Gun Owners actually spreading misinformation about this law. Oh, it's going to be great. Everything's going to work out just fine. If that was the case, Jim, then why did lawmakers very quietly and very secretively suspend these new training requirements from taking effect in a month?
So here's the answer we've got kind of secondhand, because they won't talk to us. So, and they haven't for, 5-6 months. Is that Section 75 of the law has to do with the training to get your license to carry FID card. And at the bottom of the law, there are sections that say, this won't take place for another whatever year and a half, because, they have to have time to get things in place, whatnot. So apparently they meant to suspend this for 18 months. But they put in the wrong section number. They put in 74 instead of 75. So what they're saying is, oh, no, we meant to suspend this thing the whole time. Well, the state police didn't know that when they initially had to just tell everybody, listen, we have no idea what we're going to do with this. So just keep doing what you're doing and we'll figure it out. So if that was the intention, you'd think the state police would know about it. And here's another because. When the bill was on the final bill was on the floor, the senator in charge of the bill on her side said, oh, no, we've talked to all of the state agencies. They know exactly what we're doing. They're all on board. Everything's good as far as that goes. I'm guessing maybe not.
Maybe not, because as I recall, and correct me if I'm wrong about any of this, but wasn't it July 31st that the state police initially came out and said, okay, we know the law's about to go into effect. We don't have the curriculum. So just keep proceeding as planned for now, right? That's what they said in late July.
But here was the problem with that. And as soon as they issued that letter, what they did, they sent a letter to all of the certified instructors. That was the best way to communicate this. So as soon as I saw the letter, I'm like, are the police chiefs on board? Because they're the ones that have to do all this, take the certificate, issue whatever.
Right.
And sure enough, a bunch of police chiefs came right out and said, no, the law says you need this certificate. You don't have this certificate, don't apply for license because you're not getting it. So that was the problem for, well, since the end of July. Now, fast forward to this. Okay, you've changed it to supposedly clarify it. Okay, give you the benefit of the doubt. Have you reached out to every police chief and every licensing officer in the state and every instructor in the state saying everything's status quo for the next 18 months? Of course, the answer is no. So now we're going to have even more confusion going forward. But it's okay. The bill's solid. We don't have to change a thing.
Yeah. Well, that's another issue here, right? So, this new training mandate is now suspended for what, 18 months, or is it just suspended until it is a year and a half?
It's as of, well, what was that? August 1st, I
Okay.
guess. I had to do a little bit more
Okay,
research, but
so
yeah, it's
16-ish months or so. But the legislature did that, but there's been no official notification from the Massachusetts State Police, it sounds like, right? You guys learned about this. In fact, how did you learn that this
It was
bill had been
actually an
changed?
attorney that does work for Second Amendment license, applicants, and
Yeah.
he's the one who found it. Well, he used to work in the state house too, so I'm sure somebody said, "Hey, did you know about this?" And that's how things happen. But here's the other thing, Cam, is that it brought attention to something that we knew pretty much knew existed, but with all the egregious things in this bill, it was like, yeah, okay, whatever. It also delays what it's called Section 35, and that was already in the law, but for some reason they doubled down on it and just restated that that and the other section were, put off for 18 months. So that kind of got our attention to that Section 35 a bit more. And what that section does is train, because there's so much more that the retailers have to comply with, serialization, registration, guns they can sell, guns they can't sell, tons of different stuff, security in the store. That was supposed to train the retailers on what they needed to do to comply with the law, as well as how to comply with the annual inspections now from local police. The other piece of that section was to train law enforcement on the new laws, on how to enforce things, how to do inspections. So that training too is being put off a year and a half, but all the mandates are not. So they have to comply with everything. The law enforcement is supposed to enforce everything, but nobody's going to get trained on it for a year and a half.
I mean, how on earth is that even supposed to work? Do you think that they're going to go back and amend Chapter 35 again to fix that, or is this going to be one of those, when the grenade goes off, then they'll realize, oh no, there's a problem here, and we got to go back and try to fix this.
Well, what I think is interesting with Chapter 135 is that every time a state agency kind of comes out from their bubble that has anything to do with this law, they're like, oh, no, please, no. Because, well, you got to remember the other thing, Cam, there's no budget for this. There's no money to do this. There was never funded. We heard a rumor the other day that the state may actually have to take out a bond bill just to pay for the enactment of this whole law, because it's going to cost millions of dollars. The new registration systems, the training, I mean, you name it, it's going to, nothing on the government end is cheap. So yeah, it's going to be insane for quite a while, for sure.
But again, flawless piece of legislation, right? Nothing
Oh,
to worry about, just misinformation on the part of the gun owners, actually. And again, Jim, I mean, I want to remind folks how this particular piece of sausage got made, because that is important, right? I mean, the House came up with their bill. It was very, very expansive, all kinds of sensitive places. I would say slightly worse than what actually got signed into law. The Senate had their competing bill. The two sides couldn't agree. They go behind closed doors. There's one public hearing throughout that entire process, right? One chance for the public to weigh in. And then when the two sides couldn't come to an agreement, they go behind closed doors in this conference committee. Supposedly, this was going to be an open process. And then they changed their mind on that, too, and said, no, the public's not going to be allowed to participate or see how these how this bill is being made. So they emerge a couple of months later, bill in hand. They vote on it the very next day, the House and the Senate. And you just talked about, you know, you talked about Section 35. You talked about Section 75. This is what, 100 and some odd pages of, and it's not just legislatees. Like, if you've read pieces of legislation before, you know that there's a lot of just, you know, real technical jargon. This bill is even worse because it just repeatedly refers to different sections of code. So you literally have to be sitting there with the statute book in front of you, or you've got to have the website open so you can constantly refer to what it is that they're talking about. There's no way to read the bill and see what it actually does.
No, no. And the, what made it worse too, Cam, when we were trying to go through it initially.
Yeah.
They renumbered the existing sections of law. So trying to refer to things we at least sort of knew for 25 years. Now you couldn't because the sections were renumbered. And then what they would do is take a section of existing law, break it apart, and then shotgun it through the new section numbers. So you're like, okay, they took this out, but where'd they put it? So now you have to kind of do a search. Did they actually put it back in? And here's one of the, I'll give you a great example. We literally had hours to go through this before they voted on it. So 116 pages long. What we did was I started from the top. Mike Harris started from the bottom. And we just worked together to get to the middle to figure out, well, here's a problem we ran into, that if you read one section of the bill and researched it, you wouldn't know that on the bottom of the bill, there might be two other sections that affect that one section that you were researching. So, some of our initial summary wasn't quite correct because we hadn't had time to confer on what each other had gone through because we weren't given any time. So it was like, wait a minute. And literally, one of the sections at the top was, it looks like you can use your welfare card to buy ammunition. And that's what, well, okay, whatever. So that's what we put down because that's what that section says. Mm-hmm. You didn't realize 100 sections later, they clarify something that kind of undoes what they just did. It's like, oh, my head.
Right. So, I mean, again, I mean, and if you guys were wrestling with that, there's no way that the lawmakers who voted on this bill had the chance to read, digest, and understand everything that was included in here. And yet again, they passed it within 24 hours, went to Governor Healey's desk. She signs it into law. And here we are today. All right. So let me ask you, because the first lawsuit that was filed against H4885 dealt with the training requirements.
Yep.
Do you think that this move to suspend these new requirements for 18 months, I know what you're hearing. Oh, it was a mistake. We meant to do this all along. Do you think this is actually a response to the lawsuit that was filed?
Well, I'm sure it could have been. The other thing that's a possibility is because there's a referendum petition being passed around and they're collecting signatures that will delay the implementation of the law for 2 years. Until the elections in 2026. All along, the governor has been threatening to sign an emergency order, which would enact a law immediately. But we've always kind of thought that she knows if she does, she's putting her agencies on the chopping block because they are not ready for this thing. So was this originally a mistake? Well, that can't be because, you know, Chairman Day said this thing was flawless. So I don't know if we can believe there was a mistake made in this thing. But the other thing is, did they focus like a laser beam for two reasons, our lawsuit, and then also if she wants to do an emergency action, they want to get rid of the training part for a year and a half so then they can implement the rest of the bill. It's a possibility.
Okay. All right, so
understand all that, Kim?
Yeah, I do. But it's interesting because, okay, so October 9th, I believe, is the deadline to collect the signatures. Then they've got to be turned over to the Secretary of State, I think, by the 23rd. So again, we're looking at roughly the same time period. Maybe that's the 21st when they have to be turned in. But there's, you know, just a couple of days window from when those signatures have to be submitted to the Secretary of State and when some of the provisions of this new law are supposed to take effect. I'm curious, Jim, you know, let's say that the Coalition for Civil Rights gets enough signatures to put this on the ballot. Sounds like they're really close to getting enough signatures to have it on the ballot. A little bit more than halfway there to actually being able to suspend the law, because you need a higher threshold of signatures to make that happen. Can the legislature go back and change the law once it has been, let's say that Governor Healey, you know, signs that emergency preamble. Okay, now everything's in effect. Can the legislature then go back and say, okay, well, we're going to amend it too, so that, you know, the new roster requirements are delayed for 18 months. You know, the new, you know, compliance that has to be done by the part of local law enforcement, that's now delayed another 18 months. I mean, it seems to me like nothing is set in stone here. And the way the law works in Massachusetts is the legislature essentially has the ability to make it up as they go along. And there's not much that citizens who are fighting these bad laws can do about it.
Well, that's the issue, is that, you know, let's just say the scenario is they get enough signatures, they suspend it for 2 years. The problem will be that they could literally change this thing through the legislative process 100 times. And then it might make the ballot question void or useless, because then you'd be repealing something that, well, sort of exists, but sort of doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
They can play all kinds of games with this. And that's why I said at the very beginning, we need to go at this from every angle possible, whether it's lawsuits, whether it's petitions, whether it's protests. I mean, you name it, you got to go at it. And unfortunately, one of the problems we face and everybody else faces is the keyboard commandos that just, you know, file a lawsuit and that's it. Well, you know, one of the things, I spoke last Saturday in front of a group out in the Berkshires. And they were very nice. And I explained to them about the lawsuit stuff, though. And I said, how many Second Amendment lawsuits have been filed, let's say, in the last 20 years nationwide? There's a lot. And how many have succeeded in a favorable decision from the United States Supreme Court? Six. So filing a lawsuit is not always the answer. It's actually rarely the answer. And I mean, with all the shows that you've done, how many successful lawsuits have they had, you know, in Chicago and Illinois, and have they actually changed anything?
Right.
It's like, you know, one of our attorneys said, this is like playing whack-a-mole. It's just, you whack down one problem and three more come up. So it's just the game they play.
Yeah. I mean, look, we've seen that since Bruin, right? With all of the post-Bruin laws, including the devil's snare there in Massachusetts. And, you know, I mean, listen, that's not to denigrate litigation. I mean, that's obviously a huge component. Yep. But as you say, you can't put all your eggs in one basket, right? I mean, if you look at how our rights are being attacked, they're going after it through legislation. They're going after it through regulation, right? So government agencies promulgate these rules that we then have to follow. And then again, there's the culture war attacks, right, where we're making it socially unacceptable. And then you look at, you know, the federal level, the state level, the local level, right? The gun control lobby has a very expansive game plan to go after our right to keep and bear arms. And so you're right. We can't just rely on one strategy and say, well, we're just going to sue and then our rights will be protected. You have to continue, you know, even in a state like Massachusetts, where you guys are so outnumbered in the legislature, you have to continue lobbying lawmakers. You have to continue, you know, pointing out their failures. You have to continue trying to educate the public about what's really going on here. All of those things are crucially important. And I would argue, you know, in a battleground state like Massachusetts, it's maybe even more crucial that you start to engage in these types of, you know, education efforts than it is in a state where our rights are, frankly, far more secure.
Well, it's really interesting to see how people, and you can't blame them, but they have no idea how the system works anymore.
Yeah.
And, you know, I read a quick book by Richard Dreyfuss, you know, one, it's called One Thought That Scares Me. And it's all about how we haven't taught civics in school for 50 years. And it's on purpose. They have no clue. Matter of fact, when I was speaking Saturday, a woman asked, she goes, I don't understand this. We have a Second Amendment right. It's a civil right. It's in the Bill of Rights. How can the legislature do this? And we should just be able to walk away and say, no. I says, listen, what people don't understand is the legislature could literally reenact slavery tomorrow. They could. And then it would be up to us to go to court and fight it. And the look on their faces when I said that was like, that can't be. Legislature is completely immune from everything. They can do anything they want. And then it's up to us to fight back. But then there's no repercussions on the actual people in the legislature at all. And they're astounded when they learn that. And it's, but again, it's like the Supreme Court. You know, I had a member one time, it's like, this was a while back before we even filed our first lawsuit. He said, why aren't you guys filing a lawsuit? And I explained how expensive it is and how long it takes. And, you know, the attorneys that have to be involved. And he said, well, I got a cousin that's a lawyer. He'll do it for free. And why would they? They have no clue how this works and how complicated it is, because we're never taught, you know, the civics involved in all of this. And
listen, on the one hand, they're out there, they're paying attention. They do care about this issue. Right. But that's again, this is why the educational component, I think, is so important to help folks understand, you know, how broken this process is. And, you know, again, the most effective ways that we can use, the most effective strategies we can use to again, try to regain these rights that are lost through ridiculous actions like what we've seen from the Massachusetts legislature. All right. So what's the bottom line here? I guess the bottom line is, for at least the next year, nothing new is going to change unless the legislature decides, we're going to go ahead and institute this. For now, the current status quo when it comes to training, that's going to remain in place.
Yeah.
But give it another month, and we may see some big problems for retailers, for law enforcement, and for gun owners in Massachusetts when some of these other provisions kick in.
Because the big question is, as of October 23rd or 24th, whatever the date is, from retailers and from gun owners, what can I sell and what can I buy? So far, no answers. So that's going to be the big one. But yeah, it's fun times up here, Cam.
Yeah. Well, listen, Jim, I really do appreciate you coming on the program to talk about this with our audience. I know that we've got some Massachusetts gun owners who are listening. Hopefully they are a little bit more informed and aware now what's going on. And meanwhile, you know, if you are a Massachusetts gun owner, the signature gathering process does continue for another couple of weeks. So there are dozens of locations. Check out your local gun shop because they're probably collecting signatures. But make sure that you sign your name to put this matter before a vote of the people here in 2026. And Jim Wallace, thank you for everything you do in a very frustrating environment. I really appreciate it. And I always appreciate you coming on the show, sir.
All right, Cam, thanks a lot.
My thanks to Jim once again for joining us on the program. I assume it'll be a few weeks before we have Jim back on, but you never know, given everything that's going on in Massachusetts. I will tell you that tomorrow on Cam and Company, we're going to be talking with California Rifle and Pistol Association head Chuck Michelle. Chuck on Monday tweeted out something that I may have known at one point in time, but honestly, I'd forgotten about it. And that was the fact that in 2005, Kamala Harris, who was then the district attorney in San Francisco, backed a ballot referendum called Proposition H, not Preparation H, like the hemorrhoid cream. Although this referendum, had it actually taken effect, would have caused a lot of burning and itching and other problems for gun owners, because it would have banned the sale and possession of handguns in the city of San Francisco. And all current handgun owners would have been told, hand them over to the local government. That's what Kamala Harris backed as district attorney. You know, the supposed Second Amendment. I support the Second Amendment, right? Kamala Harris? Yeah, yeah. What does the Second Amendment mean to Kamala Harris? I mean, 2007, she signed an amicus brief saying there is no right to keep and bear arms in the Second Amendment. 2 years before that,
She told San Francisco gun owners, you're going to have to hand them over. Also, while she was the district attorney, she said, hey, listen, you might be a legal gun owner, but that doesn't mean we can't go into your locked home and inspect to see whether or not you're storing your firearms properly. Again, all of these things coming from the mouth of the supposed Second Amendment supporter, Kamala Harris. So we're going to detail particularly Harris's anti-right to keep and bear arms viewpoints when she was the district attorney in San Francisco, because Chuck was the main attorney who litigated after Prop H passed with 53% of the vote and actually blocked that law from taking effect. Remember, this was pre-Heller, right? This was 2005. So this was 3 years before the Heller decision was decided. At that point, it was, at least legally speaking, in the eyes of the courts, an open question as to whether or not the Second Amendment protected an individual right to keep and bear arms. And there was not actually the Second Amendment was not the main thrust of the argument that was used to undo Proposition H. Of course, a couple of years after Prop H passed, we did get the Heller decision in 2010. We had McDonald, which said not only can the federal government not ban handguns, but state and local governments can't ban handguns either, which put an end to, you know, Kamala Harris's gun confiscation plans, at least until she was in a position to perhaps undo those decisions through her own Supreme Court appointments. So again, we'll be talking about Chuck Michelle about that on tomorrow's program. Right now, let's turn our attention to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. We'll start there with a case out of Chicago. Website CWB Chicago reporting a migrant charged with necklace snatching robbery near Goose Island. And yes, not the first run-in with the law for this Venezuelan migrant. In fact, CWB Chicago reports that an arrest warrant was already out for Anthony Laya Alvarado, also known as Elvis Laya, for failing to appear in court for a pending misdemeanor retail theft case. And then on Saturday morning, he was charged, at least over the weekend, he was charged with a crime that took place on a Saturday morning, robbery. For allegedly snatching a woman's necklace in the Clyburn corridor. According to CWB Chicago, the 37-year-old victim was walking around 10:50 Saturday morning when a man grabbed her necklace and jumped on a e-bike, basically, that another man was operating. A Chicago police officer, who was aware that the robbery offenders were both riding on that same motorized bike, tried to detain Laya Alvarado and another man. Around 11 a.m., both men then pulled away from the officer. The driver managed to escape, but officers arrested Laya Alvarado after the victim confirmed that, yes, he was the guy who snatched her necklace. The police report stated that police found a yellow necklace with an R pendant when they searched Laya Alvarado. That would be the necklace that was snatched by the woman. Prosecutors charged the 27-year-old with felony robbery, but Cook County prosecutors did not ask the judge to detain Laya Alvarado pending trial, which has to be done under Illinois Safety Act. And the judge ruled that Laya Alvarado can be free. He's just supposed to wear an ankle monitor while he's awaiting trial. Now, he did detain Laya Alvarado on the outstanding warrant, at least until the Cook County judge handling that case can see him today. According to CWB Chicago, records show that Laya Alvarado failed to appear for court on August the 12th. Judge Peter Gonzalez ordered the clerk to send him a postcard reminder. When that didn't work, Gonzalez then signed a warrant on September 22nd. According to CWB Chicago, there are four other illegal immigrants currently awaiting trial on allegations that they snatched necklaces and phones. Two are accused of doing it after the Lollapalooza Festival. The other two allegedly did it at a, another music festival, the ARC Music Festival, over the Labor Day weekend. All right, on to today's Armed Citizen story from Erie, Pennsylvania, where authorities say a man was shot after reportedly trying to enter a stranger's home early Monday morning. GoErie.com reports that two adults inside the home were questioned by police after the man was shot, but nobody taken into custody. It appears that this was a case of self-defense. The shooting reported about 3:30 Monday morning. Officers who responded found a man sitting in the front yard of a nearby residence with a gunshot wound, according to Deputy Chief Rick Laura. One of the individuals inside the home, a woman, told police that she was asleep when a three-year-old child, one of five kids inside the residence at the time, woke her up and said, "There's somebody at the front door." The woman looked out through a Ring doorbell system. She said she saw an individual standing there at her front door. So the woman woke up her boyfriend. He didn't recognize the person either. And this is when I have to say, I think these homeowners made a mistake. They went to the door. The boyfriend then opened the door to this stranger at 3:30 in the morning. And that's when the man allegedly tried to enter the residence. A struggle ensued. During the struggle, according to Laura, a gunshot was fired. Again, this was sounds to me like a case of self-defense. But if a stranger comes to your door at 3:30 in the morning and you don't know who they are, you don't have to answer the door. Yeah, heck, they can come there at 3:30 in the afternoon. You don't have to answer the door. But I would say middle of the night, somebody you don't know trying to get in your home, they're not there to sell you Girl Scout cookies. Even if this is a case of mistaken identity, you've got the Ring doorbell cam. You can talk to them through the doorbell cam, right? And that, I think, would have been a much better way to address this stranger at the doorstep than opening the door and allowing that individual to at least try to gain entry, giving him the opportunity to do so, not necessarily allowing it. But we'll keep our eyes open for any more details in this case, and hopefully we'll learn what's going to happen there with the suspect as well as the homeowners going forward. Finally today, a good deed of the day in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. Police officer in Groves, Texas, who was honored after saving a woman from a burning apartment building. The detective, Stephen Boudreau, recognized with the life-saving award for his bravery when he saved a woman at the Beverly Place Apartments last month. It was August 21st when fire broke out at the apartment complex. And the woman in question had nearly passed out from the smoke. Her apartment is on fire. And Boudreau said he was scanning the Groves Fire Department channel when the fire broke out. He said, usually they'll get calls for house fires or CPR and progress calls before we get them. And I like having the heads up. So when he got there, he said he could hear residents crying for help. He said, I really don't know what was going through my mind that day, but he was unable to go through the front door. He was forced to use a small ladder to get up into the second floor apartment from the balcony. He said it was another resident out there who just walked up with a ladder, allowing Boudreau to gain entry. Once he got into the apartment, he found a woman lying on the ground, barely conscious. He said he pulled her to safety. He said, when I first grabbed her, the reason her arm slipped out of my hand is because she pulled it back. She was in the fetal position. She didn't know what was going on. But thankfully, Boudreau was able to rescue that woman, save her from the smoke and the flames. And again, a little more than a month later, presented with the life-saving award at the Groves City Council meeting. So Detective Stephen Boudreau in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. We appreciate that very good deed. I'm sure that the woman who was saved appreciated it even more than us. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. Again, want to thank you for being a part of the program as always. Looking forward to seeing you back here again tomorrow. We'll be talking with Chuck Michel from the California Rifle and Pistol Association again about Kamala Harris's support for a handgun ban and confiscation scheme in San Francisco in 2005. You know, now, oh, I'm a gun owner. Anybody who comes to my house are going to get shot. Nobody's trying to take your guns. Tim Walz and I aren't going to take anybody's guns away. 20 years ago, she wanted to. So what's changed? I'm not saying she couldn't change her mind. But there's nothing in Kamala Harris's history to indicate that she actually does support an individual right to keep and bear arms. And there's a lot of evidence pointing the other direction. So again, we'll talk about that on Wednesday's Cam and Company. Have a great rest of your 2A Tuesday. Looking forward to talking to you again very soon. Until then, be well. Be safe.